My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Thanks for joining us this week as we dive into a phenomena that has intrigued me for as long as I've been into the world of the weird, and that is areas of high strangeness. From the infamous Bermuda Triangle, Washington State, Alaska, the Bridgewater Triangle, and many others around the world, it seems certain areas seem to be a window on things we should not and cannot see. Now another area can be added to this list. That is East Yorkshire. And one man has devoted his life to investigating the whole collection of weirdness that is going on. Paul Sinclair. Paul has written three fantastic books under the titles of Truth Proof. And the whole collection of weirdness. This includes disappearances, UFOs, USOs, cryptids, animal mutilations, poltergeists, mysterious army vehicles, and much, much more. Before we join Paul, don't forget you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can subscribe to us on YouTube, and please leave us a nice review on your podcast app to help the show grow. Don't forget you can also support us on Patreon for $1 a month. Now, let's join Paul Sinclair and the ongoing weirdness in East Yorkshire. In the east of England, a strange, multi-tentacled series of phenomena has been occurring to the bafflement of witnesses. The epicentre of this unusual catalogue of high strangeness in East Yorkshire is Bempton, and one man has found himself smack bang in the middle of it. That man is Paul Sinclair, and his tenacity, determination, an unrelenting search for answers has been published in a trilogy of fantastic books under the title of Truth Proof. Paul has been one of the most requested investigators since I started this show, and I am delighted he has joined us today. Paul, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you very much, and it's great to be here, and we shall hopefully enlighten a few listeners, or, well, let's hope we don't bore them to death, eh?
Well, there are worse things than listening to two Yorkshiremen talk about weird things, Paul, I think.
Yeah, there's better things as well. But no, joking aside, let's just go for it. You just, any direction you want to go, Paul, we'll just do it.
Absolutely. Well, listen, there's one quote, because you've got some fabulous, as someone that's followed your career since I first heard you on Howard Hughes's Marvellous The Unexplained a couple of years ago, I've followed you ever since then and got your books and everything and been absolutely fascinated, especially as I refer to as a Yorkshireman. But there's a brilliant quote from the first book from the legendary Whitley Strieber, who basically says, "Paul is unique in this world, a witness who is actually verifiable evidence of some very eerie and disturbing events. Fasten your seatbelts and prepare for one very, very memorable journey into some deeply hidden information." And I think that kind of encapsulates everything that's been going on and what you've done, Paul. It's incredible the variety of things that seem to be occurring in this area.
It really is, Paul. You know, and Whitley's not wrong when he said that. I mean, but it's occurring. Let's not forget that I'm just lucky to be able to document some of it. And it's the people that are telling me the stories. I mean, we've had our own experiences, and I've had my own from childhood. But in this particular area, shall we say, Bempton, Flamborough, Filey, Bridlington, all around East and North Yorkshire, there's the real, it's a multifaceted phenomenon. It's it, I've Multi-phenomena area is what I've called it, and I don't want to bamboozle everybody with strings of words, but everything seems to be presenting. You've got the UFOs, you've got the alien big cats, as in alien to the United Kingdom. You've got the aircraft that have crashed in strange circumstances. People who've just seemingly vanished from the stretch of coastline around eastern North Yorkshire, sort of centering between Flamborough Head and up towards Scarborough, but mostly Flamborough and Bempton. And when I say vanished, these people have, some of them have never been seen since. And it is unusual without sort of dwelling on the macabre side of somebody's loved one who's gone missing, but there's been no reason for them to, as in they've not had a history of depression, some of the ones that I've looked at, and they've not had some kind of argument with a loved one and decided to end their lives. These people have just been perfectly well adjusted from what I can see, gone for a walk up there and never been seen since. And to attach it, Paul, to the UFO phenomena or the cryptids, I'm not trying to do that. They're included in the truth proof books because it's unusual. The circumstances that they've vanished are unusual. So that does not mean that in any way, shape, or form I'm saying UFO is responsible for this or the cryptids are responsible, because I simply don't know, and it'd be wrong of me to do that. And jumping to the cryptids briefly, I never actually thought that I would be actively looking into such things when I started writing the books. It's simply because, newspapers have been kind enough to put little articles in over years that this guy, me, looking for information, unusual stories, and the drip feed of people, like the spider's web, it spreads out, and people have contacted me, and they've seen incredible things in the form of all things. They're telling me that they've seen things that resemble nightmare from nightmares, werewolves. I mean, it's inconceivable that people are saying they've seen them, but they're either all liars, I'm a good storyteller, or somebody's telling truth. I swear to you, I don't mind relaying stories, but these stories are coming from, in just about in every instance, first-hand witnesses. And I mean, the three para werewolf that I'm going to write about for, but including book four, is probably one of the most incredible cryptid accounts I've ever heard. And I'll hand on heart, sat here, I believe this guy is telling me the truth, and he's seen something that's off the scale of normal,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is unusual, and I'll go back to that particular sighting because that's one of the most tantalizing cases you cover, I think, because it is highly unusual and the veracity of the witness that came forward to you, Paul. It's highly unusual in the UK. I mean, I know there are certain window areas, as they call them in the States, that have a myriad of phenomena, but I just found it incredible because, like I say, from book one to book two to book three, it's almost as if there's a momentum to the phenomenon across a wide spectrum of different things happening to people. Like you've touched on there, there's UFO sightings, even USO sightings, there's cryptids, there's mystery lights, disappearances, animal mutilations, people having missing time. The Men in Black have turned up.
This is true, Paul, and it's not new. It's not because Paul Sinclair started writing about them in these books. It's been there for years. This has been there, not sat dormant. It's been there, and it's been active, and it's been happening. It's just that I've sort of exposed it. When you get into archives in the Scarborough Library, the Bridlington Library, the Beverley Treasure House, when you start looking into their microfilm archives, and you I don't know, you find a big cat sighting. Obviously, any listeners to UK, no big cats in UK allegedly, but we've got, what you tend to get is a spate of big cat sightings, like a big black panther, over 4 or 5 days or a week tops, where you've got multiple witnesses who don't know each other, and it makes the newspaper, and then it disappears off radar. It's not seen again. Now, if this was a genuine bona fide flesh and blood creature, which as some people think they are, and go with it, I'm willing to be proved wrong, but what I'm saying is, if it's moved on to another area, why aren't we hearing about it? It's the location that's the key. Short lane between Bridlington and Bempton seems to throw up big cat sightings. Buckton seems to throw up big cat sightings in a place called Rudston. Rudston is interesting, right from, for instance, in the 1990s. I hope I'm not boring people because I've sold some of these stories before. Well, a lot of them. But in the 1990s, I think it was 1994, 21 armed police officers, helicopters from RAF Leconfield, looking for a lion. A lion. I mean, that's just off the scale of puma or panther. Mm. And we've got multiple witnesses and enough substance to the story to get 21 armed police officers searching for this cat, which were never found, but it was seen over a week period, a 7-day period by multiple witnesses, including a woman and her husband who claimed it were actually in their garden. Mm-hmm. People at Waldgate, a guy, a painter and decorator, driving home one evening, and he said this thing were just sauntering along the side of the road like you'd see of them in the native country of Africa.
Yeah,
this is an apex predator, Paul. This mm-hmm. this would have been hungry. That we would have been seeing devastation of livestock or even human fatalities, but we never saw anything. So there's something different about these sightings, in my opinion. But what I'm meaning is the phenomena, when to jump briefly back to your question or what you were talking about previously, the phenomena's always been there. Mm. You can look in lifeboat logs and you can find all these call-outs to the unexplained lights. Obviously, they're nothing to do with the paranormal at the lifeboat station and the Coast Guards. They're purely looking for a ship in distress or a downed aircraft. Nevertheless, decade after decade, year after year, we've got documented evidence of call-outs to unexplained lights over the sea, which are then put down after these massive sea searches, in some instances, with multiple lifeboats from all areas, Filey, Bridlington, Hornsey, Hull, a false alarm with good intent. It does not seem adequate for what they've been out searching for. But we've denied the existence of something which has been strong enough to launch the lifeboats, to get all this attention. But when there isn't an answer to it, false alarm with good intent. It's crazy.
It is. And it's something that struck me as well in the books, is that, like you say, one of the key aspects of it is that the vast majority of cases and incidents that you cover, Paul, are straight from the horse's mouth. These aren't, oh, my auntie saw this and friend of a friend. These are people that have had real physical encounters with a variety of phenomena that has left the majority of them in your books and the way you discuss their stories quite shaken.
The jumping briefly to the paratroopers, the X3 para, it's absolutely turned this guy's head inside out. His friend doesn't want to talk about it, and by the way, I know his friend exists. I've know enough about the pair of them to know that it's not just one man relaying a story and telling me that he's got a friend. I know they were there. He's allowed me to record him retelling the story and the emotion in his voice, and it's incredible. I mean, I've spoke to him today on another level. He's not well, this guy, and I've spoke to him today about something else, but he still gets on about this creature, this thing that they saw on, when was it, February the 7th, 2019, so this year. And you've got to ask yourself, are they all liars? And were me and Bob Brown imagining it throughout 2017, when we could see these big yellow eyes like golf balls observing us in darkness on, I won't say every night, but on many instances when we were up on them cliff tops on our own. And this is in fairly close proximity to where the animal mutilations were taking place. But one thing doesn't seem to add up with the other, because the creature that the three para, and we might do that story if you want, Paul, but that he claims to have seen does not seem capable of inflicting the damage that I witnessed firsthand when I was sort of documenting these livestock deaths, because in some instances it's a very sharp implement that's took the ears off. It's something clever that's took the eyes out. Without sounding macabre, people, I'm not trying to put you off your tea or whatever, but it's in some instances the eyes have been removed and it looks like a hoover's taken them out. Now, we all know that a sheep is a dirty white color when they're in the wild, you know, just munching on grass and things. Mm-hmm. When you've got something as traumatic as slicing an ear off or removing an eye, you're going to have blood. There's no blood. So, and the faces are stripped to skin in most instances, and you know, it begs the question, what's doing it? Because it does not, even though he's got this creature that is described and seen on February the 7th, to me, it doesn't sound like that creature. So is it just another example of the multi-phenomenon area at work? And I'm not putting these animal mutilations down to the work of men, because it's not just sheep. And in most instances, remember, the sheep had lambs with them. It was always the fully grown ewes, the 70 to 80 kilo ewes that were getting hit, but also taking roe deer, also taking badger, also taking harbour porpoise, the marine mammal, all in close proximity to these fields. Now, we've got some kind of killer, have we, then, that's potentially airborne, land-based and marine capable, which to me is incredible. Or have we just got a weird set of circumstances that there's porpoise being found in the same time frames close to where the livestock are being found, with not similar injuries, but the porpoise are having huge holes in the jaws, the sheep are having the throats removed and the faces stripped to skin. I think we'd be silly not to be strongly inclined or strongly leaning towards the fact that it's the same perpetrator. But we can't, once again, just like the subtitle of the first book, Paul, The Truth That Leaves No Proof. I've got no proof. The phenomena leaves us with nothing. And that's not just Paul Sinclair. I think that's for investigators throughout the world. When it hits you, when somebody's hit by the unexplained, be it your own personal encounter, be it a sighting of a ghost, you know, in your, I don't know, in your bedroom or in your hallway at home. It's made such an imprint, you know you've seen it, but can you prove it? The only place it exists is in your mind, that visual in your mind. And it's a difficult one. And I'm sorry for spinning around in a few places there, guys.
That's quite all right, Paul. I wouldn't expect anything less. I mean, we'll because we've both touched on it, so we'll dive into this three parasiting. But before we do, it was really interesting, because obviously the description and everything, and obviously when you tell it, people will see. I was lucky enough to speak to a lady called Linda Godfrey the other week, who is synonymous in America with a phenomenon known as the Beast of Bray Road.
Right.
Which is essentially an upright werewolf running around the woods of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And it's something that's occurred. She discovered the story at the beginning of the 90s, New Year's Eve, I think it was, back in 91. And here we are, almost 30 years later, and she's now essentially the go-to woman. When anybody hears anything weird going on in Wisconsin, which strikes me as one of the weirdest states in America, she is the lady. So when I read your books, it was interesting that there were some real parallels. But then again, it beggars belief, Paul, because this particular sighting, you have to be incredulous to doubt the man's testimony.
You really do, and it was... Did you go to the Awakening Conference, Paul?
No, the last one I was at was at the Outer Limits.
Right, okay, I remember meeting you there, but at the Awakening we played this guy's recording, and you can almost feel the emotion in his voice, because he's seen something that's off the scale of normal, and we've also got to understand he's an ex-soldier. He said to me, he said, I've been in conflict, I've been in sort of situations that are sort of life-ending. And what I saw on those clifftops at Bempton, it's incomparable. The fear level it just doesn't compare to anything I've ever experienced before in my life. And it really makes you think, because, I mean, we can't say that that's responsible for, A is responsible for B, because we don't know. But, and I don't actually think, listeners, that there's some flesh and blood creature able to sustain itself along the eastern North Yorkshire coastline, because I just don't. But also, when you do a little bit of research and a bit of Googling, you will find out that if you look, that 6 miles down the coast, you've got the village of Barmston, And if you remember a few years ago, you'd got the stories of the Beast of Barmston Drain. The common link here is the coast. Everything's running along the coast. So, you've the stories of the Beast of Barmston Drain. You've got people reporting werewolf-type creatures at Danes Dyke, which is just a few miles away. Then probably 2 miles inland at Flixton, 12 miles from where I'm sat, you've got the stories of the Flixton werewolf. If you go up the coast towards Ravenscar and Whitby, you've got the folklore, the old stories of the Padfoot and the Bagest, the sort of huge black dogs with flaming red eyes. And it makes you wonder, these stories of old, these stories of folklore, all this stuff's running along the coastline. And if you go a little bit further up, you come to a place called Sand's End. And I've got a first-hand account from a rock angler at Sand's End who was in a fishing match one evening. I've not got year in front of me. I didn't know we would be doing this. And he recalls, when we say a fishing match, guys, you've got to understand when they're doing this rock angling, they're usually on sheer cliff edges in the middle of the night. And they're spread out. Only you might see another angler half a mile away, and you'll know he's there because of his headlight, you know, the LED torch. So they're not sat together. And on this particular night, this guy's fishing, and he sort of flicks his... He feels a bit uneasy. And that's a common thing as well. There's almost a perception that there's something not quite right. And I think that's a thread that runs through every kind of paranormal experience. People have sort of a second sense that, so, you know, the feeling we've had in, I don't know, when you think you can feel somebody's watching you and you turn around and they are. Well, he said I felt a little bit uneasy, and I sort of spun the torch around and looked. He says, and further up the cliff path, I can see a set of eyes. He says, and I thought, oh, Christ, what's that? Because the big eyes and the high up, they're not on ground, these are high. So his immediate thought was that it was a cow or a horse. That's the kind of height these eyes are coming down to him. And he said the sort of head dropped, and he thought it had just dipped from view because he's only getting the eye shine. Carries on fishing, feels a bit twitchy, looks again, and they're there again, and they're a bit closer. And remember these torches, these LED torches, they go for hundreds of yards. I've got a really powerful one that will sort of scour the paths. But anyway, he gets a bit nervous now. Ed goes down. He flicks the torch back. It's back up and it's closer. And that's what he said. These eyes were yellow, big, widely spaced apart. Now, he didn't see what we've been talking about, like in the form of an upright fur-covered animal or hair-covered animal. He just saw this large set of eyes, probably 6 or 7 feet off the ground, not human, he's absolutely certain, coming towards him. In the end, he was so frightened, he cut his fishing lines, grabbed his rod and his gear and did a runner. So that's as close as he got to it. But interestingly, he was very close. And if you look on maps, to an area on the edge of the cliff called Beast Cliff. I mean, I wonder why they've named these places in ancient times after these things. It's like jumping to Flixton, and people will have heard me say that Flixton used to be called Wolfland.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it could be that it's because wolves were prevalent in eastern North Yorkshire in ancient times. But a few miles away from Flixton, at Hunmanby, it's called Hunmanby, Hundman, Farmstead of the Houndman, Farmstead of the Houndman. I mean, there may be quirky little phrases and things to say, but it's true. And when you're actually using these in connection with people who've said they've seen these unusual creatures, it makes it a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's always struck me as well, Paul, because East Yorkshire is probably one of the few areas in Britain that has a history of wolf legends and things like that, because obviously probably the most famous one from that side of the country is Old Stinker. Which is knit towards Hull, I believe, which is allegedly a werewolf type creature, and stories of that go back centuries.
Yeah, that's correct. But a few of the stories of the Beast of Barmston Drain, and I don't doubt the people who originally stepped forward to say that they'd seen this, whatever it was, this creature. I can't remember. I did try to contact the lady that had said she'd seen it, and I don't doubt their stories. I think there were about three people, once again, that claimed that they'd seen it, individual witnesses, unconnected to each other in the period of time that it was seen. But a few of the stories are actually the Flixton stories that have been dragged into it by other people to bolster up the Beast of Barmston Drain story. They talk about it attacking a timber wagon, the Beast of Barmston Drain, which is just total fabrication, because the timber wagon that got attacked allegedly was by the Flixton werewolf on the A1039 road that runs through Flixton. So, you know, I'm not saying it's of any great importance, but sometimes a bit of research does get mixed in with others just to add a bit more weight to a story.
Well, I think, and that's another credit to your work, Paul, I think, because you're very good at sieving this out and sort of disentangling these stories that seem to have been, as you say, moved around the locality slightly to kind of bolster a particular story. But you're very good, and I think it's all credit to your tenacious nature. You're brilliant at unpicking these stories to actually go, no, this is what happened, but also to dismiss things that you know are just local urban myths.
Well, there's a guy, I don't know, I can't remember his name. He's messaged me on the Facebook Truth Proof page to say that he'd spent years around Flixton in the dead of night. I assume probably rabbiting or whatever they do. But he spent, I'm sure he said over 20 years. He says, in all that time, I've never, ever heard of the Flixton werewolf. And I've asked farmers and they've never heard of the Flixton werewolf. And all I can do, I mean, I've no axe to grind with this guy. I mean, he's not being rude when he's saying this. He's just stating a fact. But I can't answer him. Because I've spoke to people who have seen it, and I have spoke to farmers, one quite recently who's from Flixton, who's four generations and never heard of it. He did, and this guy's told me two stories of his own, and I would have thought one of them's even more bizarre than a werewolf, which I'll touch on in a moment. But then again, there's another farmer in Flixton who, when I first started looking into the story, sort of laughed at me and thought it were a load of rubbish. And then when I bumped into him again, I can't remember the time period that had lapsed, but I told him a few things that I'd found out, and he went, I've seen it. I says, you what? He says, I've seen it. As a young boy, it's about 11 years old, at the top of the burial mounds at Sharp Howe. And that's the kind of attitude you've got, because that guy denied any knowledge of it when I first spoke to him, yet he gave me an incredible account. But I mean, here's one that I mean, the listeners are either going to think I'm crazy or they're going to think, well, that's interesting. I think this story is interesting. Now, this is the Flixton farmer who's never heard of the werewolf. And he says to me, when he was a young boy, about 10 years old, I think he said his sister were 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. One particular night, he's on the farm. And interestingly, he's connected a dot for me. Their farm is built on what was Carman's Spittle. Just to briefly jump from it. The refuge that was built to protect travellers from an infestation of savage beasts in 937 was at Spittle Corner between Staxton and Flixton. But interestingly, I found records of another refuge that was in Flixton less than a mile away called Carman's Spittle. And I found it in an old book and there's reference to it, but nobody can remember its existence. But this farmer, his parents say that their farmhouse is on the ruins of that spittle. But it's interesting that you've got two places to protect travellers from an infestation of savage beasts within a mile of each other. Right, back to his story, Paul, if you want to hear this.
Absolutely.
He's in bed in the dead of night. Now, this one's going to throw all your listeners, because it did me when I heard it. And so, something compels him to get up in the night, and he goes to his bedroom window and looks down the farmyard. This guy's in his 40s now. He's not a teenager who's made some story up. He said, in the night, but he can see them, there's five dwarves walking abreast up the farmyard towards the farmhouse. You didn't expect to hear that, did you?
No.
And he said, for all intents and purposes, they looked like something from Lord of the Rings. He said he felt frightened, jumped in bed, head under covers, and that was it. Got up in the morning, pretty sure he'd seen it, but trying to tell himself he's had a dream. And he sat at the breakfast table with his sister. And sister says to mum or dad, I'm not going to pretend it were dad or mum, I don't know which one. Strangest thing last night, mum. And she says, "What's that?" She says, "I woke up in the night and there were all dwarves in the room." Now, the sister remembers this story, saying this. This guy from Flixton, David, remembers seeing them on the drive. If he says if his sister had never said that, he would never, ever have thought about it again. It was just a weird experience that he'd have put it down to a dream. But, I mean, where does reality stop and where does it start with stories like that? I find it incredible. I actually love that story. Mm. Just that quirky little story, but the sister ties it together and makes it real.
Yeah, I mean, what I find compelling about stories like that, Paul, and you can find stories like this in hauntings and ufology as well, is that people will be fast asleep in the middle of the night and for some reason they either wake up or something disturbs them and they feel compelled to either look outside or go somewhere in their home.
That's correct. It's almost like the thought has been placed into your mind. Do you know what I mean? There's a story in this particular house that we're in now. I'm in a flat now, but I've converted this huge house to flats years ago. Well, 2010 I did it, but Jessica, one of our daughters, and she remembers me waking her up. And it's a big winding staircase, or it used to be, that goes up to the top of three floors. We're at the top of the house, and she says, I woke her up, and me and her followed a ball of light downstairs. I've no recollection of it. Jessica can remember it as clear as day. I remember her telling me about it probably the next day. But so something, I've lost the memory of it, but something sort of compelled. Well, she's remembered. I've lost that memory, but you're right. And I'll tell you what else is interesting, and I'm sort of interested in it for book four. The wave of fear that these things can put over people. The same farmer who just had this story when we were talking about the werewolf, and he said, "I've got two stories." He said that he'd been out with friends in Scarborough, which would be about 6 miles, 4 to 6 miles from Flixton, this Saturday night. And he were careful to say that he'd not been drinking because he had to be up for milking at 4 o'clock, and it was his dad's farm. And he got to Spittle Corner in his car and then turned to go to Flixton. And there's a row of bungalows, and then you've got a large open space where you look down onto what's called the Cars. That's the dried up lake bed that used to be Lake Flixton. He said, and you can see Oliver's Mount in the distance, so you can get some height of things because that's 500 foot above sea level. He said, but what were amazing, when I looked onto the Cars, there's a large sphere that looked like the full moon. He said, and it was lower than the Oliver's Mount. He said, and I can't believe what I'm looking at. He said, and in the sky, I can actually see the crescent moon. He said, and there's about, I don't know, a 10 to 15 second spell where he can drive before he actually hits the village. He misses these bungalows. And when he gets... Obviously, he's watching this, and when he gets to the village, he thinks, I'm going to get out of the car. When I get to the farm, I'm going to go and have a look at this. So parks the car up, and an overwhelming wave of fear hit this man. He said, absolute terror. He said, and I just jumped out of the car, ran to the farmhouse, went in, locked the door. He said, but the strange thing is, I instantly forgot about it and went to bed and went to sleep. I only remembered the next day. There's some kind of influence that these things are able to, well, they do. They influence people. So even at that great distance, looking down onto the Cars, whatever it was, because we don't get filled with fear when we look at the moon, or we look at a bright star in the sky, or we see a meteorite flash across the sky. We're not filled with fear and dread, but in some instances, these unknowns, these UFOs, or whatever you want to call them, are able to instill. I mean, it might be just that they can project something and release a chemical inside our body, inside our brains, I don't know, that stimulates fear.
Yeah, and I mean, the other aspect, and it certainly occurs in most weird stories that I hear or when I speak to people, Paul, the gnome story is a prime example of that because, with the greatest respect, on the face of it, that's ludicrous.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Why would anybody make that story up? Because it's beyond the pale. If you're going to make a story up, you might say, "Oh, I saw a giant dog or a panther." Yeah. You know, these are the traditional kind of weird things you would see. You wouldn't jump a million miles to the side and say, "I saw a gang of gnomes walking up my drive." I mean, it.
I have a breast. Oh, it's crazy.
Oh, and that for me often makes me think that's so strange, it probably did happen.
Yeah, you know, obviously, without putting this guy through a lie detector and without, well, there's no way of going back in time and proving it, but we've got to take it on face value. I speak to a lot of people, Paul, and some of them, you know, I'm always polite, but some of them think, oh, I'm not going to write about this because it's clearly, they're not seeing UFOs, they're seeing dust orbs caught in camera and they're showing me these pictures and I can't see a demon in that picture that is and through them branches. I can see, I could see 1,000 demons if I look hard enough. But it's, and once again, listeners, I'm not always right. Mm. But when you, all I'm trying to do is relay stories as best I can. And I set off on this journey because of my own experiences. So there's no way that I ever intended talking about cryptids such as what people perceive as a werewolf. I really didn't. And look where we are all these years later. And we're sort of actually actively looking and thinking these things could exist. I don't know how. And I think it's interdimensional. But, you know, I mean, they could be thought forms. Who can say? But the field is open, and I am open to suggestions because I'm no expert in this. I'm just gathering stories and forming my own opinions and throwing them out there.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite peculiar as well because prior to this, really, Britain didn't have a particular area that was known for such a wide variety. I mean, I'm quite fortunate where I live. I live on the edge of the Peak District, which is a UFO hotspot.
Yeah.
But it's not traditionally, you know, we've not got stories of big cats around this neck of the woods. There's some dotted about further down at the bottom of the peaks, Paul, but it's not a localized phenomenon that travels all the way up. It's specific. And this situation that seems to be going on in East Yorkshire. I was speaking to a gentleman from Australia called Tony Healy, who specialises in all kinds of weird phenomena. And he's very much akin of the feeling that it's as if a curtain's been drawn back and things have fallen through from a variety of different scenarios.
I would agree. See, that's why I've sort of saying the multi-phenomena area and a thin area, and these thin areas probably exist all over, and it's like throwing a stone into a pool and the deepest part, and then you get ripples of the phenomena leaking out into different areas. It's all, you know, a few miles away from the area that we do a lot of research at Carnaby. A few miles away in Carnaby, you get UFO sightings for some reason. Like I said, Bempton Lane and Short Lane, you get the cat sightings and UFO sightings. It can't be coincidence. And I would like to bet, Paul, that the place that you were on about with the UFO sightings, if somebody really put, yeah, I don't know, 15, 16 hours a day in, that, I mean, that's the problem. Most people don't have the time.
Yeah.
You might find that it is a multi-phenomena area. This stuff at Bempton, and I'm sorry to keep saying Bempton because we'll call it East and North Yorkshire. These things that are happening, it's not new. It's been happening a long time. And believe me, there are people in these villages that are fully aware and have seen. I know through ex-wives of some of the farmers and, well, one in particular, that one of the farmers who's saying, oh, this is a load of rubbish, is actually sick when he was married to this woman and looked at what they perceived as a spaceship. Mm. But he'll go on social media when anything's in the paper about something unusual seen and ridicule them. And not in a bad way, but he's sort of having a real attempt at playing it all down. Yet the same man's actually seen stuff. They're in denial. And, you know, I know that some of these people have a lot more knowledge of what's going off than they're letting on. I mean, I spoke to a Coast Guard, very fortunate to speak to this Coast Guard from Hornsey, which is not far away, who's given me the most detailed UFO account, well, as detailed as he can be, from 1998. I think he said February the 10th. I was like, just plucked that out of air because I wanted an exact date because it was very close to the time that the newspaper, I can't remember the national newspaper, reported that a UFO the size of a battleship was seen flying over the North Sea. Mm. And this guy's given me this account. And he said it was 5 or 6 miles off the coast, a strip of lights out over the sea, off the sea. He said whatever it was absolutely monstrously huge. And because I'd been telling him about this 1,000-foot UFO, this story that I'd been writing about, and he says it were bigger. He said, now do I think it was spinning? He says, because one light would go out on the right-hand side and another one would seem to appear on the left, and it were just constant. And he thinks whatever it was, some huge saucer-shaped object. And that were 1998. I mean, I can't... He said, if you held a pencil out at arm's length sideways, it would be that big. Now, I can't imagine anything that we've got man-made that we could project, hang over the sea, silent, bigger than a battleship in 1998. I mean, I could be corrected because, as we know, there's lots of things that are being developed and are being tested that we have no knowledge of or we're potentially not supposed to, and that they are responsible for some UFO sightings. But when you get into things that big, it's incredible. In book two... The farmer from Hunnamby, you may have read the story, and where they went out into their courtyard to have a cigarette, and above them there was a monstrously huge boomerang-shaped object just hovering silently above, low, above the farmhouse. And everybody in the farmhouse came out and looked at this thing, and it just went on its way very slowly, and they were ringing farmers up, warning them that this thing was coming. It stopped a wind turbine as it passed over someone's farm. A guy I spoke to, I think his surname was Pickering. Another interesting aspect of it, and he never got to see this, but he heard the hum. One of the farmers had a child's toy train, the type that you would sit on, a new chargeable, all flashing lights and everything. And he'd got it on eBay for sale and it didn't work. But as this thing passed over, it lit up and everything started working on it. So it had got an effect on some kind of electrics. Just incredible stories, Paul.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I wasn't surprised when I saw some of the incidents you mentioned in all three books, Paul, because there is a very famous case that happened out off the coast in the North Sea in 1952, Operation Mainbrace.
Yeah.
And I remember it because apparently the incident started on my birthday. So as one of those people, I always try and see if there's any weird news that occurred at any point on my birthday. And this is a particular one where the RAF and the US Air Force had an encounter with a glowing object not too far away from where you guys are. So for me, seeing these stories, it just automatically clicked that, as you say, Paul, you're not the first person to shine a light on these stories, but you're probably the first person that's pulled them together and said, look at everything.
I think we've got to look at everything. And because we can't see how it connects, maybe the only connection is the location. But there is an invisible thread that's linking it all somehow. It'd be wrong to say that the big cats are connected to the UFOs, or this perceived werewolf that's been seen on the cliff tops at Bempton is responsible for the animal mutilations. But there's a definite correlation to the times it's been seen and within the same time frame that the animals are being killed. And likewise, the light forms, the lights are being seen as well. I mean, I wouldn't link the lights to the missing people, but I can remember, and I think it was 2017, I was on the clifftops with Bob Brown, and we filmed what I've termed the intelligent light forms on November the 5th. Now, before listeners think they've been filming fireworks, this is out over the North Sea off Flamborough Head. These are spheres of light that, for want of a better word, look like a tangerine in a blue sky. They don't light the sky up like a flare would do. They don't light it up like any kind of luminescent thing would do. They're vibrant and bright, but they're just within themselves. We saw them a total of 13 times on November the 5th. Interestingly, and I'm saying it, but I'm not saying it's connected, but I find it interesting, they were a body found in a sea cove on November the 7th, just off North Landing. I don't know much about it. I don't know any more about it, really, than what I'm telling you now. But it's never been explained fully. And we've not heard that it was suicide. It's an interesting one. But once again, unusual things happening. Was the lights responsible? I can't possibly say, but I do find it interesting.
Absolutely, and I think when you delve into this field, Paul, you very quickly come to the conclusion that coincidence doesn't explain everything.
No, no. Well, gather this one then. I mean, I've looked into the story of ZA610, a tornado that crashed over the North Sea, I think it was December the 12th, 1985. Mm. And the thing that got me into the story, Paul, and really sort of caught my attention was the Bridlington Free Press ran an article, you know, a few days after this aircraft had crashed, saying it was December the 17th, ZA610's been found. The navigator of ZA610 has been found in an ejector seat. However, a second body has also been found 36 miles to the east in an ejector seat. But that is not the pilot. Only one aircraft crashed. There's only two people in a tornado, but that wasn't the pilot. So that set me off on that investigation. And what an incredible story ZA610 is. I'm not saying it's UFO related, but it's very strange. On the 16th of December 1985, the Scarborough Evening News said the Ministry of Defence spokesman had found the aircraft in 200 foot of water. I think they said using sonar and underwater TV equipment, and there was no sign of the navigator or the pilot. Hmm. Which, it's interesting, a Ministry of Defence spokesman said that. Then on the 17th, a trawlerman called Tom Quinn with some other trawlermen in a trawler called the Betty found the navigator. And in a totally different place. Obviously, the Ministry of Defence retracted what they'd found and said it was a false alarm. But, I mean, the guys who found him were told by the operatives of HMS Brecon, the minesweeper that came on board, that should they suffer nausea, vomiting, loss of hair, nosebleeds, they've got to seek medical attention. They asked why. They said, because he's potentially radioactive. They cast all their catch over the side because it were potentially contaminated. There's loads more. We could actually do 2 hours on ZA610. Yes. Usual story. I've got the Board of Inquiry report, which I don't know which section it is, but one of the buccaneers, because they were supposed to be, I think it was nighttime refueling, claimed that he'd seen lights pass down the port side. And it couldn't have been ZA610, so the board concluded that it was a nighttime illusion.
I mean, that's one of those always wonderful things, Paul, when some of the excuses. There's a famous UFO sighting from New Zealand in the 1980s that was initially dismissed as cabbages reflecting moonlight, even though these people were 20 miles out to sea.
It's crazy, isn't it? It really is. There's a story from 1966, and there's three guys in a small cobble. That's, they use them for sort of hauling crab pots and lobster pots around our coast. Mm. And they're under Crab Rocks at Bempton. And they're in this cobble, which is still in Bridlington Harbour today. It's called the Imperialist, the boat. And these guys, there was the surname, two of them were Jewetts and one was Stevenson. And it's Stevenson that I'd spoken to. He said, we're all in these crab pots up, obviously by hand. There's no winches. He says, and we could see a reflection in the water. And we all sort of ducked and looked up. And just above their heads, we're not talking hundreds of feet, just above their heads, there's a milky white glowing sphere. And it's silent, and it's just above their heads. And I said to this guy, and these are real deep sort of slang to their voice. I said, how big? And he went, thirt ball. I went, what? Thirt ball. And I got it in end, a football. It was as big as a football. And I said, what happened to it? He says, it literally just went like a firework. We could see like the trail of it as it went. And it just disappeared in daylight, above the reds, 1966. What did we have that was man-made that could do that in 1966? If we'd got things like that back then we can rule the world today, because we've come a long way since 66.
Mm, very much so. I mean, it is quite interesting as well that some of these witnesses, like I say, there are these gentlemen, as you refer to there, who quite clearly explain what it is and just go, I don't know what it could possibly be. But I know there's a couple of stories that you've covered where the witnesses basically say, oh, yeah, I've seen some lights in the sky. It was a meteor. And I think you said to him, did it move? And he went, no. And I was like, well, how can it be a meteor then?
This is true. And you get this. And these guys, they're not, I don't mean they're silly, but what we do as human beings, all of us, myself included, the first thing we'll see, or we do when we see something we can't explain, is look for a logical answer. And if you're of the mindset that you don't believe that, we'll say in UFOs, it's a bit of a cliche, but I don't believe in UFOs, that you're never going to think it could be anything else. So when I talk to the rock anglers, and I've talked to quite a lot of them over the years, some of them will say, oh, the meteors, that, and then I'll go, well, what did you see? Well, orange light appeared, and then like another two appeared at side of it, and they're in a line. And I said, well, did they move? No. I said, well, I don't think there were meteors, do you? And but you're not going to change them. That they don't want to believe that there could potentially be anything else. I mean, it could be a living light. It could, these things could have intelligence. They're not forced to be some structured craft behind them. You know, I'm tending to think, to be honest with you, Paul, that there is something triangular shaped within these lights. And why do I form that opinion? Because I've spoke to quite a few people around this area and further afield, I'll jump to one in a moment, who've said that these lights have been up close and personal over the top of them, and they've seen three points of light inside it. So that kind of throws me to idea that there's some field around whatever it is we're looking at. You know, and we do see these things up on the Wolds, which is inland, you know, the farmland and the sort of barren areas of open fields up on the Wolds. But there's a guy who I'm going to include in book four, and his name's John, and I think I can use his surname, actually. He's told me, but I just want to make sure before I say it on radio. So his first name's John, and I won't be saying his surname here. No, but he's an he's an ex-project manager for the MOD. And during the job that he was working on for the MOD, they put him, this is in Cornwall, they put him in a house that overlooked the sea. And this particular evening, he sat outside with his wife, we'll say he's having a beer or a glass of wine, I don't know which. And it's not dark, and it's, but it's just such a nice summer's evening. And they see, I think it were five lights. He's done me drawings. They see five lights over the sea. And he puts, there's binoculars on them, and the pyramid's inside the lights, like a copper-coloured pyramid. And they're turning, and he can't believe what he's looking at. He's just amazed. Whilst this is happening, two starlings, it sounds like something from Steven Spielberg's Taken, two starlings fly at the patio doors and kill themselves. Not instantly, one flies, and then a short time later another one does. That could be just coincidence, or we've just spoke about, haven't we? So he's looking at these lights. He's sent me all the news clippings from that sighting, because these lights were seen by many, many people, and it was 2013, but I can't remember exact date. Well, we'll have the details when we actually get it into Truth Proof 4. But then it gets even more bizarre. When he goes to bed that night, they're awoken by a noise downstairs, and they go down, the television's on, it's just static, and it's full blast, and it's shh, and it's going. They turn it off. I think he said it come on again. Then that night, when he's in bed, he sees unimaginable terror, is what he said. His wife couldn't wake him, and he's given visions. And I believe he has been given visions of all his family and all the people that he loves killed. I have described the ways, and I'm not going to describe them to on here, but in ways that are just absolutely horrendous. Yeah. But what's interesting, he said he could even feel the blood, the warmth of it hitting him. And this is in the dream state. But this is after seeing these triangles, these spheres of light with the pyramids inside them. Now, is there a possible link to the perceived dream state scenario that he suffered that night, because he said he's never had it before or since? I think there possibly is. Can we prove it? That's the big one. Not a chance. But there you go.
I mean, it's fascinating, Paul, because like you say, things like that are often, you know, as we mentioned a couple of times, always put down to coincidence. But for a man who's had no history of night terrors, as you we could possibly call that, and has never had a repeat incident, even though that dream is so vivid he can remember it. Therefore, the potential for him to relive that dream, even if he's dreaming about having the dream, would be there, and he hasn't reported that. I find that astounding, really.
It's a brilliant sighting, and I'm sure he's allowing me to use his name, and it's from a credible witness, and like, you know, yeah, it is astounding. It's a really good sighting. I mean, there's so many people that I've got to thank. I mean, without these people coming forward, I mean, I'm writing Night People, which is a book about my own experiences from childhood to present day, but you know, I've enough to fill a book with that. Well, based on it's been took some writing, but without the people that are coming forward, Paul, with these accounts, there wouldn't be no truth proof books. All I'm doing is telling the stories and throwing my slant on it. I mean, obviously, Truth Proof 2 covers quite a bit of my research into the animals, and well, and Truth Proof 3, but I've got a lot to thank for the people that come forward. That basically, that's what I'm saying.
I think, but that I think speaks volumes, and I've said this to a couple of investigators, Paul, that have started with cases that seem to have just blown up out of all proportion to what they potentially thought at the beginning of it. And it's always, I think it's good to see that people, when they know of you, they realise that you're credible, you're honest, and you'll treat them with the respect that has perhaps held them back from telling their story.
Without a doubt, the Coast Guard who told me about the UFO sighting, obviously these people, he signs the Official Secrets Act. I'm not going to reveal his name. There's just no way I'd not include the story. Believe it or not, Paul, and I'm not going to say what it's about, but I got a story off Colonel Holt this week from Rendlesham.
Incredible.
Yeah, and he's allowing me to write about it, and it's nothing to do with UFOs, but it's bizarre enough to be going into Truth Proof 4, and he's going to allow me to write about it. I only received the story 2 days ago, so I've got to ask him more questions before I can do it justice to talk about it. But, you know, in view of the guy's past and the Rendlesham Forest incident, I think it's going to be quite an interesting little cameo of a story. It's not going to fill 10,000 words, but it's an interesting story, and I'm very grateful for him for contacting me and sharing it with me.
Absolutely. And I think it's good for the general public as well, Paul, because like you say, you were not the first person to be aware of these phenomena. You know, the story's going back decades. And I think it's one of those moments where when you first started this, did you comprehend how it would, where we'd be these years on?
No, not at all. I'd always made my mind up. I hated work, you know. Sorry for saying that, people. But I think most I worked very hard, not blowing my own trumpet. People who know me, they'll know that I worked till steam come off my head. And I earned quite a lot of money, but it were all with my hands. And I've just got to a stage where I could pack in at 48. Mm. Not because we've loads of money, because we've got these flats. So that's nice. And I thought, right, I'm going to write a book about this unexplained phenomena now. I didn't think it would there would be so much interest in the books. I mean, there is. Every single day there's something new I'm being told or something that I'm looking into. And so, well, basically, I'm rambling again, guys, aren't I? But no, I didn't.
No, it's all right. Listen, Paul, you can go whichever tangent you feel happiest with, my friend. It's not a problem in the slightest. And I think with a subject like this, it's difficult not to.
It is. And I find most difficult part of the unexplained phenomena, be it ghosts, spirituality, and trying to prove the existence of God, werewolves, whatever it is, And ultimately, you know, I think all this stuff's linked, but we don't have the vocabulary, and I've said this before, to actually describe what we're seeing. Its existence is denied, so it can't be named, because once this phenomena is openly admitted that it's real, we will create names for these things. You know, and we've got the name werewolf, but we've just got the generic UFO, and we've got people that talk about Delta Batwings, and we've got people who talk about these star systems and all. I mean, they could be right. I have no idea. But we need academia, we need science to accept that this is real. They won't accept it's real because it leaves no proof. And sometimes even the people, the men of science, are having these experiences, because they can't get their head round them, they're going down the rabbit hole of sort of burying my head in the sand scenario, because it's so difficult, and it's such a frustrating thing to be looking into for yourself, for listeners of this show. We know that most of the people listening are listening because they've had an experience of their own, and they're looking for answers. And they probably sat there round a dinner table or sat round a bar having a glass of wine or a beer, and the subject of the unexplained will come up and they'll tell their story. And what do they get? They get laughed at. We just can't prove anything, Paul. That's the frustration. And that's part of my job, as I see it, not just collecting the accounts. I try to make them as convincing. I try to do the witness as much justice as possible. I don't lie about it, but I try to go through all the scenarios of what it couldn't be, so that we rule everything out before the reader, the skeptic, the debunker starts coming out with, well, it's November 5th, that were fireworks. Or, bloody hell, that, well, that a Chinese lantern. No, the wind was blowing off the land. We've got to do the witness as much justice as we can. We've got to sort of paint them in the best light possible if they're relaying an actual bona fide experience.
Yeah. I think the other thing that struck me as well is the fact that, you know, some of these people seem extremely sheepish until they kind of, you know, maybe they have more than one conversation with you, Paul. And I think it's that initial conversation that it's usually your continued ability to keep talking to people that eventually gets to the actual crux of their experience.
Exactly. Now, I'll just... We've got time to do this, I think. November the 30th, 2013, and this will tie in with what you've just said. The Thornwick Bay UFO. Now, this was two security guards that had an incredible experience on the cliff tops, Thornwick Bay, November the 30th, 2013. Now, they were in... I've changed the story, but not the truth of the story, to protect their jobs. I went to speak to them about lights that they'd seen over the sea, the spheres of light. And he allowed me to record him because I told him I was going to write about it. And I says, is there anything else? He says, turn your recorder off the record. And then he told me this story. I said, look, I'll change your name. We'll alter the scenario of the job. And I said, and I assure you that's what will happen. Let me record you. Let me have this story, please. So we've got this story, and they're overseeing or doing the security for a geological survey on the clifftops in 2013 in two porter cabins that are interlinked. So that bit's true. So during the night, have we got time for this, Paul?
Of course we have. As long as you have, I have.
During the night, you know, we'll say in between 12 and 2, I think he said 2 a.m., they became aware of a sound, a strange noise. Quite low, not very loud. But the unnerving part of this noise was that they could feel their insides. We liken it to when you go to a rock concert and you can feel bass checking your internal organs. They could feel the heart. They knew where the liver was. They knew where the kidney was. It was some kind of infrasound. Something was happening. And they became very, very frightened and nervous. They didn't know what was happening. And they experienced this unusual sound. Then he said, and he pointed to the window. He said, then this light came in the window. And he didn't mean that suddenly somebody put a torch on and it lit the cabin up. Yeah. He said the light came in, like, as though it were poured in. He said, and the entire porter cabin's filled with a silver white light. And all the time this sound's sort of affecting their insides, and they've terrified these guys. Then there's a flash of light and it's over. That's part of it's over, but outside the porter cabins, there's a huge luminous blue sphere. And we gauged the height because, you know, the barriers that go up when you let cars through, through somewhere, it's like a car park or somewhere. Well, there was some of them close, the 17 foot. And he said it was higher than them, or at least as high as them, and the width of the two porter cabins side by side. So we've got this monstrous blue glowing sphere that they're looking at, and they daren't go outside. And then instantly, it's gone. They didn't say it flew away. They're not quite sure what happened to it. It's just gone. The frustrating part for me is they caught this on two CCTV cameras. One of them, close to the cabins, showed Thornwick Bay as a whiteout. And that's probably because of the brightness of the object overwhelming the camera. Then there were another camera further down that showed the beautiful view, blue-like sphere, and the cabins, and they'd got all that. And he had it on his phone for, I don't know, he said he had it on his phone for years until he changed his phone, and he hasn't got it now, which is, isn't that the case?
Yeah.
But that's just another example of someone, you know, I went to him to talk about the spheres of light over the sea, and I'm asking if there's anything else, and he realises that I am good for my word. I'm not going to expose where they work or who they are. We've changed his name, but it's a true story. And I've got the recording, so if anybody decided they wanted to put me on the spot and say, you just made this up, you're a complete liar, I would willingly say, come to my home, listen to this. And I can do it with a lot of people because they'll allow me to record them. We know that I'm not going to go to the lengths, am I, of finding different voices to tell me different stories to fabricate the books. That would be ridiculous. So I'm trying to give myself some proof and some credibility of what I'm telling the listener by recording their stories. But I always maintain witness anonymity. Hey, oh, we can't say it.
It gets me every time as well, Paul, don't worry.
Every time. So, and we've also gathered that I can't say words correctly.
Oh,
so
there you go. Both. Me and you both, sir. I mean, it's one of those things, because it's an area of the country, obviously, growing up in South Yorkshire, Paul, that I've visited numerous times. And I've been stood, obviously, prior to me being aware of you and your work, but I've been stood there on a rocky outcrop at Flamborough Head on a particularly blustery day, and there's a quiet brooding atmosphere about the place, even though it's traditionally known as a collection of seaside towns.
Well, yeah, don't forget, Paul, during the daytime, I mean, the actual nature reserve is bustling, and it gets people from all over the country and overseas coming to look at this fabulous seabird colony that nests and breeds on the cliffs, you know, and then during the winter months you get the rock anglers go up there on a night. But even so, in our documentary Bringing Down the Light, what I've done with Chris Turner, we've got a guy there, Ian Norris, who's gone on film and told us about the day that he went to the bird sanctuary with his wife for a walk. Lovely sunny day. His words were there were hundreds of people on the cliff tops. Now, I don't know whether there are that many, but what we'll get is there's a lot of people up there milling around, a lovely sunny day, and he's close to the RAF base. Mm. And he said he's looking up at the RAF base. This is derelict, by the way, people. There's no windows in it. There's the cows use it to shelter in, and I wouldn't recommend either. I need to stress that anybody thinking of going up to see the RAF base or anything on that land, I discourage it entirely, because I do write about strange things that happen up there, but I don't want to be seen as encouraging people to be going. Mm. But he said he looks above the base and there's a huge torpedo-shaped object. He says, and I thought, it must be tethered. It's only low and it's dark grey, and he shows it his wife, or she's looking at it, and it's massive. He says, and I'm looking at people on the cliff tops and people in close proximity, and we're pointing to it and showing them. He says, and it's like we're not there.
Yeah.
Nobody's interested. And he said, like, and I can't believe it. He said, and we're trying to bring this to people's attention and they're not looking. He says, we turn away for a moment, and when we turn back, it's gone brilliant white. It's just a brilliant white colour. So we decide to walk up the side of the base in, you know, on the side that's legally to be able to walk up. And as we're walking up, we're looking at it, and then we sort of talk to each other, and we look down and try and point to it. We turn away, and it's gone. So that is a daylight sighting, and I have been told by some staff at the RSPB, the bird sanctuary, that bird spotters and people who've gone down there to photograph the birds and things have come back and told them that they've seen unusual things. But I think the bulk of the activity just like the bulk of the alien abduction phenomena and things like that happen when there ain't a lot of people there in the silent hours, in the early hours when it's devoid of people, you know. And I think that's how it works basically across the board with this stuff, because it's always one step ahead. It always seems to take us by surprise.
Yeah, and I think there is something unique about that area as well, Paul. As you leave the main towns on the coast, you know, within 10 miles of you coming inland, you're basically in quite remote farm communities. You know, these are higgledy-piggledy little villages scattered along, you know, lonely lanes all over the place.
Well, that is correct. I mean, they're a bit like mining communities. And you'll know about these kind of communities, where everybody, you know, they have their own sort of little clique of friends and clubs. And there's nothing wrong with these people. They're good. I've got some friends, and most of my wife's brothers were miners. They're very loyal, but you've got to be in their club. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm fortunate to get reports from some of the trawlermen, because one of the trawlermen broke away from the sea fishing to work as a ground worker on building sites for quite a few years, and he's very well respected, and we became good friends. And so now he's back at sea. It sort of was a lever in for me to be able to go and talk to these men, because I'm good friends with this guy, do you see?
Yeah.
And it's no different with anything, really, but I don't know. I mean, whether we'll ever get to the bottom of all this, Paul, I don't know. But I think as researchers, not just myself, we're never going to do it unless we're feet on ground. You're not going to do it looking at a laptop. You can read other people's reports, and you can surmise what's happening, and you can take snaps of dust orbs on photographs and things, you know. But you've got feet on ground, real research. That's where it's at.
Absolutely. And I, for one, I'm very glad that you've taken this task upon yourself, Paul. So listen, thank you for your conversation tonight. I shall let you go, because I could keep you here for hours, and I know you've got plenty to do, as always. So, where can everybody get hold of your books, Paul?
The books are available on Amazon. We also have a website, truthproof.webs.com, where they can be purchased through PayPal. There is a Facebook page, Truthproof Facebook. Anybody who's got a story that's interesting and they'd like it's sharing and they want to remain anonymous, please contact me. I treat everybody like they treat me. If you know what I mean, treat people as you find, and we're all good. Don't bother buying the books until you've read reviews. I'm not here to sell a book. I'm here to sell the stories. I'm here to look for answers. And regardless of whether you're interested in the books, I want your information, and I want to get the word out to people that this subject that we're immersed in is real.
Yeah, brilliant. And you've also touched on the documentary.
Oh, the documentary, yeah. I'll see if I can get you a link for that off Christopher Turner. I mean, Chris has already made some great films, called Bringing Down the Light is one of them. Listen to this. Paul and Chris have made Bringing Down the Light. I've lost the plot, man, haven't I? So,
it's all right.
But he's also made Elusive and Don't Mention the Reptilians. And a lot of the work that's been done on the YouTube, the Truthproof YouTube site, is thanks to Digital Creations, and that's Les Drake and Leslie Kirby, because I've them to thank for uploading the short talks and YouTube information. So, you know, there's that. If anybody wants to look at the short talks we've done about the light forms, about the cryptids, there's things to look at there as well.
Absolutely. And I recommend everything heartily. As someone that's got the books, Paul, I'm blown away by your hard work and your dedication to this.
Well,
all power to you. I know next year you're probably going to carry on building momentum and getting busy for you, because you've got your book coming out, which is The Night People, I believe.
That's correct, yeah.
And then you've got Truthproof 4.
With Truthproof 4, which it'll be slower. I am going to write a book, well, we've started it, with John Hansen.
Yeah.
The Police UFO Files, and I've found a title for it, and we're going to call it Project Blue Light, the Police UFO Files.
Fantastic.
And I should think that probably will be out before The Night People. Mm. But I'll have to, that's John Hansen depending. I mean, John's got a wealth of information in his own archive, which is probably one of the biggest in the UK.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I look forward to that, especially. Brilliant. I love stuff like that. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Right. Well, listen, Paul, once again, thank you so much for your time today, and all power to you. And good luck on your expeditions and investigations out there. Keep safe.
Thank you very much.